Hi, welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and I've hosted the show for more than 5 years, bringing you experts from the world of integrative medicine for cancer. The show's named after the charity I set up over 15 years ago to support people with cancer in exploring the many benefits that integrative medicine can offer to support them through treatment and in securing a lasting recovery. My guest this week is a highly experienced nutritional therapist. Dawn Waldron specialises in supporting women with breast cancer, and today we've chosen to focus on the role of stress in the lead up to the treatment and the recovery from breast cancer. I'm speaking to Dawn over the internet. Hi Dawn, welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Hi, thank you for having me on, Robin. It's nice to talk to you today.
So it was brilliant to have you as part of Your Life and Cancer 2020, our recent 2-weekend online event. There you were talking about nutrigenomics, and now this is actually your first appearance on the Yes to Life show, long overdue, may I say, and it's great to be able to talk to you today.
Thank you.
We settled on the topic of stress and breast cancer for today, firstly because you specialise in supporting people with breast cancer, but secondly because the role of stress in cancer just kept on coming up again and again over the 2 weekends of Your Life and Cancer. Speaker after speaker underlined what an extraordinarily important factor it is to address. One of the most powerful voices to speak about this was Sophie Savage. She was talking about what is probably the main driver of stress, fear, and she actually spoke about it in just the same way as many practitioners might talk about, say, inflammation, a symptom that's hugely important to address. So I'd never heard anybody talk about stress like that as a kind of symptom, but does this reflect your experience?
I think it does, actually, Robin. As you know, I have personal experience of breast cancer, and then I've got a 23-year survival record, and I've been working with nutritional therapy for 17 years. So I've met a lot of women who've had breast cancer, and stress comes up time and time again in as a very fundamental thing. If I say to women, why do you think this happened to you? Stress is going to be the answer for about 90% of them.
Wow, really?
I find it fascinating because it's at a very felt level, at a very intuitive level, that people feel that. And then when you look at the evidence, you look at the research, you can start to understand why that might be the case. It's not just some sort of namby-pamby or some woo sort of idea that stress isn't very good for you.
Right.
It does have a physiological effect, and you likened it to inflammation. It does. It has a set of, you know, it creates its own sort of environment and has an impact on the microenvironment. That's very important.
Well, we're going to go on to talk about all of that, I hope. But you just mentioned fact that you, like many other people who speak on this show, have got your own experience of illness, and that's played a central role in the development of your life's work, really, I think. Would you just tell us your story a bit more fully?
Yes, sure. I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 33. Back then, we didn't understand all the receptors. I like to say it was in the last century, and we didn't have all the receptor knowledge that we have now. But I was estrogen receptor negative, chances are that was what we would now call triple negative, although I don't know my Herceptin status. My prognosis, I was given at the time a sort of about a 30% chance of being able to speak to you today. I had a 2.5-year-old daughter. I was working as a management consultant. Stress was just part and parcel of my life without right. any question. I was burning the candle at all three ends, I often like to say. And so I did the whole thing. I did the surgery, the chemotherapy, the radiotherapy. I had the most fantastic care. Both my surgeon and my oncologist were people that I stayed in touch with, and they were wonderful people.
Nice.
But I sort of knew in it at a sort of instinctive level that it wouldn't be enough to just take the medicine and go home and live how I had been living. I knew there was something about the way I was living that needed to change. And so I did go back to work for a while as a management consultant, but I also went off and I studied at ION, and I did the diploma with ION at the time, and then went into full-time practice. I went into teaching for ION and had some lovely years there before I went into full-time practice. But I also developed a sort of dangerous tongue condition in the sort of, I think about 2006, called proliferative verrucous leukoplakia, which is normally associated with 55-year-old Indian men who smoke. And I didn't have any crossovers with that particular demographic. So I was a little bit surprised by that. And it is quite a rare condition. But it carries, my understanding is it carries a 40% mortality rate, even in the pre-malignant state. And I went for a second opinion, and Dr. Stephen Chalicum, who was at that point running ENT cancers at King's, said to me, well, it will go malignant. You've probably got about 5 years. And I didn't like that.
No.
I didn't particularly like that conversation. And I thought, right, okay, I'm going to sort this out. So that summer I did various things, including, I'm not going to say exactly what I did because I think it's personal. I don't want everybody to start doing exactly what I did. But nevertheless, I really changed my diet again.
Okay.
And I took some very high dose therapeutic levels of some nutrients, but I also stopped lecturing because it was it was becoming too much for me at that time with everything else that was going on with family life and my clinic.
Right.
And within 6 months, these patches, which were supposedly would never disappear without surgery, tongue surgery, they had gone. And I'm really sort of no stranger to the idea that we can sort of change our body for the better, and that stress plays a part in it.
Well, all very interesting story. Could I ask what you said you went off to study at ION, you know, quite soon after your initial treatment there. What drew you to nutrition particularly?
Well, I had a wonderful friend. I've always been a great cook. And interested in healthy food. I had a wonderful friend, Susie Wallace, who in fact hasn't made it through to today. We had cancer at the same time.
Oh, right.
And we went off to India together. It was the plan that we did. We didn't in the end because her chemotherapy got in the way. But anyway, we were going to go to India. We had all sorts of ideas and adventures planned. And she said to me one day, she said, do you know, I don't know why you don't go into nutrition. You're really interested in it. And it was just one of those conversations. We were on a train.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, I don't know why I don't either. And so I looked into it. And it was really, you know, sometimes a friend can give you the most amazing insight that you can't see for yourself.
The obvious.
And it was such, it is such a vocation for me. I probably bore people stupid with it. But, it has definitely become my life's work without any question.
Yeah. Okay, and so have you done any further training since your initial training? Have you gone on to study other branches of nutrition? Or
yes, I have. I particularly well. First of all, about 2009, I started to recognise the sort of pivotal role of our sort of attitudes, particularly around stress, and the way the shape of our personalities sort of impacts the decisions we make and what we take on, and certain things that patterns I was seeing with my clients. So I dabbled with the idea of training to be a psychotherapist, but decided it would take me too far away. Okay. But I did go off and train to learn how to do life coaching properly.
Okay.
So that I could sort of tiptoe into areas which need delicate handling with clients, but really help them to see where they might be getting in their own way. So I did that and added that to my bow, my skill set, I suppose I should say. And then in, I guess it was around sort of 2012 when I became fascinated by the Thomas Seyfried work.
Yes.
And the role of the recognition of reprogrammed metabolism in cancer. That was the point at which I started to think, yes, we really can wade in here. We have a role. And then I went back, I did some functional medicine training, and I went back and I started a master's, which I haven't finished.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot about looking at the evidence. I threw myself into it, got a postgrad certificate, and then came back out to clinic because, to be quite honest, I'd rather be working with people than working in an academic environment for the most part.
Right.
So, I'm constantly trying to keep my skills up to date. And now I guess, you know, I read primary research most of the time to try and keep up to date with what's going on.
Mm.
I think I will always train and retrain because I think it's important. And I'm, you know, I often say that people who come and see me in clinic, that they're just as likely to benefit from something I learned yesterday as something I learned 15 years ago, you know.
Fair enough. But there's certainly been a lot going on in this field, isn't there? I mean, we're light years away from where we were when you first had your training at ION, I imagine.
Yeah, completely. I mean, back when I was training at ION, we didn't really have a cancer lecture. In fact, at the time I was leaving ION, my first year sort of when I joined the education team at ION, I ran a cancer workshop there, which was sort of our first sort of direct attempt to try and deal with that subject. You know, that was back in the day when we weren't really allowed to talk about cancer or type 2 diabetes and,
right.
and that sort of thing. So we had to be a bit careful. But again, I guess it would be fair to say it wasn't always easy to see where we could intervene effectively, especially after diagnosis. Prevention, I think, it's always been fairly clear that nutrition plays a role in prevention.
You're right.
But unfortunately, most of us, myself included, need a bit more of a scare than that before we take it seriously.
That's so true about human nature, eh?
It is, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so back to the main topic for today, stress. So the appreciation of the attention that stress deserves in managing cancer has really grown out of the increase in understanding of the mind-body relationship, of the absolute inseparability of these two arenas of well-being. So would you say a little about the way that you understand and aim to address the health of the body and of the mind and spirit?
Oh, yes, I'd love to. A lovely little story to start off with. I went to Bologna a few years ago, which is one of the oldest universities in the world. and I went to the very first operating theatre, which is a fascinating place to visit if we're ever allowed to travel again.
Right.
And at one end of the theatre, there were I guess the sort of presiding teacher would sit with two models of the human body, one showing the sort of anatomy that the sort of skeleton, and the other one showing the musculature. And there was this huge marble sort of operating table in the middle, mm-hmm. and everybody sitting, lecture seats all around. But at the other end of the lecture theatre, there was a little window where the papal representative used to sit to ensure that no one touched the head. So that was a classic example of the split between mind and body,
right.
where we were not allowed to touch the seat of the soul at that time in history, and so that classic sort of division between mind and body, and between barbers and herbalists has caused a lot of problems, I think. If you bring that round to the present day, where it is almost, it's rather sort of ridiculous that we have to make a case that the mind and body are connected.
Yeah.
Because of course they are. Yeah. Of course they are. I was reading something just recently which talks about that, you know, even our white blood cells are able to secrete neurotransmitters and a lot of our hormones. And, you know, this idea that your neurotransmitters come from your head and then into the body, and you know, it's just completely false.
Right.
And we know that, really. We do know it at a very deep level. And so stress is very much part of that. You know, stress, it changes the circulation in the body. It can cause pockets of hypoxia. It increases the inflammatory response in the body. It also decreases our ability to resolve inflammatory cascades. So it's much harder to end, because obviously inflammation is important, but we need to end it, you know, when it's done its job. It raises blood glucose, which we know is important. It mucks up our digestion. It affects our sleep. So it has a fundamental impact, both on a short-term and long-term basis, on our health. And we know, for example, that the sympathetic nervous system is involved in invasion and metastasis, adrenaline and noradrenaline. So those are very, you know, all of those things tell us that we can't separate stress from the set of factors that are involved in cancer. Mm. So you know, that's very important. And then it's much more complex, I think. We tend to think in terms of cortisol. We think, yes, well, cortisol, you know, has this effect. But, you know, the adrenal response is also involved. GABA, the role of GABA as a neurotransmitter in the amygdala, which sort of changes our perception of threat. And of course, sometimes I think when we're diagnosed with cancer, you know, our perception of our own vulnerability and our sense of threat just goes through the roof.
Right.
And so we're triggered with a very sort of primal level. I sometimes think, you know, the NHS budget would be better spent sending everybody on holiday for a year.
Right.
And I know that's a bit flippant, but you know, the whole process is so stressful for people. Hmm. And I really wish we could do something about that to help people. In fact, that goes back to one of my primary motivations. You know, there was nothing for me, and I wanted to be able to provide some hope and reassurance for people at diagnosis. So, you know, and then, of course, you know, as you know, I look at nutrigenetics quite a lot, and all of those pathways have the potential to, you may have a particular genetic setup which makes you more or less vulnerable to these things. So, we live in a world where we really value type A personalities. We value go-getters. We value people that can live fast and hard.
Yeah.
And if you can't, there is a tendency to think that you're less than, or that you're not successful, to perceive yourself in negative terms. But when I do nutrigenetics with my clients, they often get a huge sense of relief when they learn that actually they may, for example, have the gene that predisposes them to have a more prolonged cortisol response, or they might have upregulated adrenal receptors or a stronger fight or flight reaction, that GABA doesn't work so well for them. So they often recognize that they've had years of thinking, I don't seem to cope with stress as well as other people. And you can beat yourself up for that. But if you understand that we do actually have differing abilities to cope with stress, and that some of us are not cut out for life in the fast lane, then maybe we could cut ourselves a bit more slack, particularly post-diagnosis. I do, you know, like to help people to change the way they look at their own productivity and their own success factors following diagnosis, so that they can take some of the pressure off themselves and reduce their stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a very important support that people need, clearly. And you're right that actually knowing a bit more about yourself can be very powerful in terms of, well, maybe I just won't put myself in the fast lane. Maybe I'll be much happier.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's the relief of that can be so huge for people. And I think particularly with breast cancer, that there is a particular gene, that we sort of shorthand, we call it the COMT gene, which is, its long name is catecholomethyltransferase. Okay. And it's one of the methylation genes. And it produces an enzyme that helps it to methylate estrogen, adrenaline, and dopamine. Now, all of those have to compete for the level of COMT that you can produce, that the level of the enzyme that you can produce. So if you have a slow COMT gene, which a surprisingly high number of the women I work with do, your body will have to prioritize between, if you're having a stressful day, are we breaking down adrenaline today or are we breaking down estrogen?
Right.
And so you can see a primary mechanism there whereby women may actually create hormonal imbalances, and there may be a buildup of toxic phase one metabolites because of a genetic predisposition that is exacerbated by stress. So, there are very clear little paths we can follow genetically to help people understand why stress is an issue.
Right. Interesting stuff. Okay.
It is. One of my favourite pieces of research when I was doing my postgraduate stuff was done in rats, and you know we all have to sort of slightly take that with a pinch of salt, but the magnesium sits in the synapse of the nerve, so it sits between one nerve cell and another, and it limits the ability of adrenaline to jump from nerve cell to nerve cell, which in effect limits the ability of adrenaline to flood the body, if you like.
Yeah.
So I like to think, if we're both in the room with a saber-toothed tiger, the person with more magnesium is the person who's more chilled than the person with a smaller level of magnesium. And you know, I love those little examples of where nutrition is so important and we where we can understand, we all know that magnesium is a sort of calming nutrient,
yeah.
but we don't always know how it works. And that's just one of the ways that it works.
That would seem to be a character trait, really, wouldn't it? But you're saying, actually, no, it's biology.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Very interesting.
And of course, they are always, you know, I often talk, Emma Bezick and I are on the phone to each other a lot. And, you know, we often say to each other, you know, everything's genetic, even your character traits.
Right. So guests on this show, they often distinguish between stress in the short term, a normal and healthy driver of necessary change, and chronic stress, a very unhealthy situation, often arises from living under difficult or unsatisfactory circumstances for extended periods, and that typically doesn't prompt change, but more a kind of stoic coping. So both types of stress tend to play a part in cancer, one in getting you to be that ill in the first place, while the other can provide the fuel to find a way forward. Would you expand on the role of stress in cancer, both positive and negative?
Yes, that's really interesting, isn't it? It's this concept of eustress, EU stress, where it is that positive stress. I think you would likely find that the chemical environment would be slightly different. So you would probably find that where we know that, for example, dopamine becomes noradrenaline, is turned into noradrenaline and then adrenaline, or that sort of cascade, you might well find that in the positive form of stress, you're more in the dopamine noradrenaline type area, and in the more negative forms of stress, you are in the noradrenaline adrenaline area. I know the Hans Seeley model talks about general adaptation syndrome and this idea that eventually we stop being able to sort of produce adrenaline, we get adrenal exhaustion, and that can be a problem. And I've read that also very much discredited as an argument. I think we need to just distinguish between that sort of, if you like, the zest for life idea, that the initiation of that primal survival response in us, when what we're doing is recognizing that the survival of the organism is at stake, versus that situation where what we're actually fighting for is something that we don't really care about, where it may, for example, be that the deadline to get something to print, or the deadline to make the train for a job that you don't like very much, or there's such a difference, and I think, to me, it's understanding. I guess we're in the sort of territory of life purpose here, where we understand the things that fire us up and make life worth living, and the things that drain us and feel essential, but maybe don't really add to the sum of things. And I guess then you start to look at things like mindset. And I love the concept of ikigai, the Japanese concept, which looks at sort of your talents and your motivations, and looks to try and harness them to help you make a living, or to help you make a life that you love. And that's something I do look at quite a lot with clients, because, as you say, there's stress and stress. But how do we work out which sort of stress? You know, life is stressful, isn't it?
Well, it is at times, yeah.
Look at us at the moment. Yeah. They've just announced another lockdown.
Right.
Life is difficult.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, and we have to. The last thing I want to do is say to people, "Well, if your life is stressful, your prognosis is rubbish," because I don't believe that. I don't believe in this idea of life has to be, you know, relentlessly positive, and we have to be relentlessly positive about our thoughts. But in an ideal world, we would find something in our daily lives that lifts the spirit, speaks to the soul, and provides some sense of balance in life.
Yeah, I suppose there's a big difference between managing stress as something you accept as part of life and having stress all the time and really not wanting it and resisting your life as it is, you know, that sort of, being constantly not at ease with your life, which is a very different picture. So I think it's fair to say that stress and cancer go hand in hand, whoever you are, whatever type of cancer you have. So much of what we go into today could apply equally to anyone with cancer or at risk of cancer. But have you found out there are particular patterns of experience or hurdles to be overcome specifically for people with breast cancer that could be described as common?
That's an interesting one. I do find, well, of course, what I do need to say is because I only work with people with breast cancer, I don't know whether these patterns are common for other people.
Right.
But I do find that work stress is a more likely one to crop up, a difficult boss, a period of time where maybe there'd been one or two jobs, or a period of time working away from home where people have just felt that their workload is completely unsustainable or unreasonable, when people feel unsupported. Mm. And I do notice that very much as a pattern, much more than sort of home stress or stress with children and that sort of thing. Mm. So, yeah, I would say that that's the thing that crops up. And I can several much loved clients spring to mind where that has been it's been very, very hard to manage that, those situations, to try and change, you know, to try and change the micro environment so that to give their body the chance to recover.
That's very interesting.
I guess one of the things about treatment, of course, is it can give people. It can give people a break. It can let them off the treadmill.
Right, right.
But of course, it creates financial stresses of its own. Mm. So a lot of it is about trying to help people find a way forward and see that a different way of operating is possible, I think. We're not always stuck with the choices. We often think we're really stuck with our choices.
Yes.
Do you find that with people?
Yeah.
I do.
Well, I felt it myself.
me too. Before I was diagnosed,
You
just think, well, I haven't got any choice.
Exactly.
But quite often there are, you can look at things a different way, or you can work out other ways of doing things. And trying to uncover those is quite important. And obviously, you know, one of the very important things that we can change is the way we respond. We can always change that.
Right.
It does sound a bit flip to say that, but, you know, if your boss does drive you mad, or if a certain set of circumstances in your life is causing you a lot of stress, you know, if it's not an option to just walk away, then it is normally an option to change the way you handle it, even if you need some help to do that, because it's so important. So, you know, I will often recommend somebody to get some help, maybe some CBT or some psychotherapy, maybe some coaching with me, to just examine your the way you react to stuff.
Mm.
Life-saving.
Very interesting. Well, this is where your two trainings, your parallel trainings, must be very useful for kind of having that kind of overview, because, cancer's a great prompt for change, if you like. It certainly gives people the opportunity to reevaluate their situation. But change is never easy, is it? As you say, people can think they literally can't change, you know. And Yeah, a bit of coaching goes a long way. I know in my experience, I've absolutely valued coaching to make some of the changes in my life that I wanted to make.
Yes, me too. And that, like most people, my interest in coaching started because I had the help of an extremely good coach.
Right.
And it transformed things for me. I think I was a bit stuck. So, yes, it can make a big difference. And there's so much we can do. I've got a lovely story of I had a, you know, during lockdown, people have struggled sometimes to access their treatment, as you know, and it's caused a whole lot of chaos for people. And, of course, a lot of fear again, a lot more stress for people. And I had a really panicked call from a client, must be 2 or 3 months ago now, for whom doing her last chemotherapy was extremely important for because of other things that were happening. She went to she had her bloods done the day before chemo, and her white cells were right down. And they said, we can't do, unless you improve by tomorrow, we won't be able to do your chemo. And she rang me in a panic and said, what can I do? What can I take? Sort of thing. And I said, well, I don't think there is anything you can take, as far as I know, that you're not already taking, that will sort this out overnight. But I think you could try visualization.
Okay.
So, you know, go have a bath, do some visualization, have an early night. And I actually looked this up yesterday because I knew we were going to be doing this. And so her white cells on the day that she rang me were 2.1, and the following day they were 4.9.
That's not bad, is it?
And so that overnight, I think a bit of reassurance, stopping herself from panicking. She had a bath. She went to bed early. She did a visualization. And her body said, okay, right, we'll work with you. And I think these are things that we don't, we do understand them, Robin. We just, there might not be a randomised controlled trial to prove it.
Right.
But we do understand them.
Yeah.
And we can have these, we can intervene and get our, you know, work with our bodies in that way. So yeah, that was a lovely little piece of, you know, almost evidence.
Yeah,
you wouldn't quite call it evidence, but so that this idea of just taking some of the panic even out of the treatment scenario, where you're constantly thinking, oh, my white blood cells,
right.
You know, again, right. If we just think, no, I'm going to work with my body, I'm going to calm down, I'm going to de-stress, I'm going to visualize, I'm going to choose to respond in a different way. It can be very powerful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned visualization. I think the kind of more left field approaches, if you like, are often very helpful with things which are sort of deeply psychological and emotional, healing and things like that, which, you know, don't seem, as you say, very randomized controlled trial stuff, territory. But they can be enormously helpful, I think, in people just sort of coming to themselves or regaining their composure or, you know, or feeling more they're on track, all this kind of thing, you know, just bringing people back to themselves.
Absolutely. And then, you know, then you start to think, well, you bring the vagus nerve into the equation and, you know, again, pulling this full circle back to the sympathetic nervous system. And you think, yeah, actually, of course, it does have a physiological effect,
right.
And we shouldn't be as surprised as we are, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right.
When things work.
So I think you'd agree that knowledge is a key to managing stress, knowledge of both what to expect, I mean, when you have cancer, knowing, you know, what you might be up against, and of the resources that are available to support you through all the challenges of cancer. I wonder if you'd finish up by summarising these two, the part that stress is likely to play in anyone's experience of cancer, and where they can best look for help in managing and embracing that experience positively.
Yeah, what a lovely thing to think about. I think that we need to understand that the diagnosis of cancer is in itself a sort of it's very symbolic, and it tends to be an overwhelming time of, you know, a certain situation that's overwhelming.
Right.
And normally at that point, the knowledge that is imparted is all about the tumour and the medical care and your average stats and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And I really want people to understand that they're not average for a start.
Right.
As soon as we look into, you know, if the average response is really not to do very much, to carry on as you are and to take the treatment and keep your fingers crossed, then just by contacting and listening into a radio show like this and looking at the resources that are available with Yes to Life, you're immediately not average.
Okay.
And you have the ability to push your survival potential into what we call the long tail, you know, so the sort of people who survive against all odds. And knowledge is very important. So this knowledge that, yes, we know that tumours tend to behave in a certain way, but one of the things that's really important is that even now we all know that outcomes are random. And that means actually at this point in time that we're not measuring the right things yet. We are not, the results are not random. We're just not measuring them in a way that shows the correct results.
Right.
And so looking beyond what's being offered to you, treatment is wonderful. Treatment can reduce the cancer burden in your body. It can reduce the chances of things coming back. It can give you time to heal. And it can give you time to look into things so that you can take better care of yourself in future. But you're not going to get the knowledge that you need for that within the oncology system. You actually need to look beyond that for healing and support to work with yourself in a different way for the future, I guess is what I would say. And that's where Yes to Life really plays the most incredibly valuable role is quite staggering. It makes me quite emotional when I think about it. This idea that there's this community of people who will help people think bigger and give them hope and give them another form of knowledge that says it. You know, you can, I guess, you can pimp your prognosis. You can you can do better. You can do better than expected.
Mm. Well, thank you for all the plug for Yes to Life. Yeah, well, I think that's why we're here, to help people. Yeah, just look outside the box for themselves and find out what they can do to improve everything about their future. So, yeah, great. And we weren't around when you were diagnosed and we weren't around when I was having to find out this kind of information for my daughter, and hence the reason that it was started in the first place. But, you know, it's crystal clear anyway that there's just much more understanding and support for people with cancer now than there was only a few years ago. And clearly you and many other pioneers like you have had a big hand in that very welcome change and actually changing the territory for people. So
I think...
go ahead.
One of my frustrations now is being only one person.
Right.
And that I can't reach enough people with the current way I work. But I am planning next year, if COVID allows, to run masterclasses, but I do want to run them in person, not over the internet.
Right.
So to run some masterclasses from home for small groups of people.
That'd be nice.
Where we can spend a day together, and that I can sort of get across the sort of things I help people with in clinic in a single day's workshop. I'm really looking. In fact, I had that ready to launch in January this year.
Oh, frustrating.
And that all got that was frustrating.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to that, to being able to reach more people, really.
Yeah, of course. It's what we all want to do, but it's happening one way or another. More people realise that, yes, I must be able to do something to help myself. I'm going to go and find out what it is. So that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, look, we're out of time, Dawn. It's been brilliant to talk to you, to hear about all your passion for this work. You're obviously so on fire with it, really. You love it, and you're obviously clearly helping a lot of people despite the frustration. So, brilliant, and great to have you on the show at last.
Thank you. It's lovely to talk to you, Robin, and thanks for the invite.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Dawn combines huge experience and knowledge with a very down-to-earth approach to helping people. She's a great resource for women with breast cancer. A reminder that on the 10th of December, Yes to Life is holding an online dinner as a fundraiser for the charity. Tickets are as cheap as chips, and you're guaranteed a fun evening featuring competitions, prizes, and some five-star entertainment. It's being hosted by two of our patrons, Jerome Flynn of the Game of Thrones and Ripper Street fame, and Linus Roach, famous for his parts in Vikings, Homeland, and many others. Together, they'll be introducing stunning entertainment from the experimentalist, Gerard Senahy, who will undermine your very convictions of what is possible with this incredible world-class performance. Find out more and book on the events page of yestolife.org.uk. Thanks for listening today. Please make a point of joining me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.